Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
I like sucking, but I ain't gay.
Legit bad podcast.
Fuck those honkies.
Kick ass.
Welcome to Costco. I love you.
He really knows how to suck a wiener.
Welcome back to Legit Bat Podcast. Ben's interrupting my intro, but I can cut that out.
No, I'm just kidding.
Our guest tonight is Mark Steves from My Family Thinks I'm Crazy and the creator, founder, slash whatever you want to call it, of Alt Media United, of which we are a part, and a bunch of other shows that you should probably check out. So, Mark, what's up, brother? How you been?
Hello. Thanks for having me back. It's been too long, as has been said. And yeah, we're here now. So I'm happy to be back. I'm happy to meet the new member of the team. And well, maybe not so new. It's just been a while since I've been back. But anyways, yeah, glad to be here. Feels like a whole new show with our new friend here, Nene. Nice to meet you.
Yeah. Oh, I did forget to say that. I'm Joe. For new listeners, Jen, Ben and Lene, and of course, our guest Mark. So what have you been up to over at your show, dude, since it has been so long since we've done a show? I've talked to you here and there in between us, but how's your show going, and what's the stuff you've been covering lately?
So this is a long answer, so buckle up.
Perfect.
I've been doing a lot. I've had recently had gone from 2 episodes a week to 3 episodes a week, and 4 if you include the other show that I started with a friend of mine. I think he may have been on your show before. His name's Roman. He does a podcast called Rising from the Ashes.
We actually met him.
Homie Romy.
Fucking
great. Oh, right on. Yeah.
Yeah, we hung out with him.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, he's up there in California too. And yeah, so Roman, my friend Chad Stemke, and Tara, my girlfriend, and I, we do a show called Esoteric America, and that's about 20 episodes in, so I know I haven't mentioned that here on the show before. So yeah, it's a fun show. We go town by town and sort of find out the weird conspiracies, cryptids, UFOs, all the strange stuff that goes on in a particular place, and we try to focus on any place, really. I mean, we've done small towns, big cities, any place in America we'll do an episode about. So that's been a fun exploration, and it's led me to also look into my own state and where I'm from and the weird history going on here. And it's not new for me to do that. It's been kind of a 10-year pursuit of trying to understand what's going on over at Yale with Skull and Bones. So I've done a considerable amount of research over the past few months into that whole subject, and I've done several interviews on shows about that. And then I guess also, you know, you can kind of include my interest in the Native American spiritual landscape. It sort of wraps into all three of those, or well, into the first two, because originally, what really struck me about Skull and Bones was my encounter with a now friend, somewhat of a mentor at the time, a gentleman who grew up in Arizona among the Navajo. He's a Native American, and came all the way out here to New Haven and told me about this Geronimo's skull, which resides in the tomb at New Haven. So that kind of disturbed me as a young man 10 years ago, learning about that. And I've really scratched my head trying to figure it out ever since. And funny enough, the Native American story is somewhat connected to the Skull and Bones saga. And I don't know if Skull and Bones yields the same power today that it once did, but it's certainly fascinating to look at Yale and see how they've really made a huge impact on our American life. So yeah, there's so many routes we can go down from there. It's really up to you for whatever you're most interested in. But yeah, I've been doing a couple new things. And of course, my family thinks I'm crazy. We've been pumping out guest interviews, and I've talked to a lot of really fascinating people lately that have helped contribute to the research I'm doing. So,
That's awesome. Let's start there, though, with what you found out about Skull and Bones, especially in relation to the Indian stuff, because that's I'm not familiar with that at all. What's your favorite part?
I want to jump right into that.
Hell yeah.
I could even pull up some slides here and show you guys a few photos, if you don't mind.
Yes, do it.
All right. So, yeah, the story starts with my friend Amos. And before I met Amos, I had an interest in Native American culture. My father had a best friend growing up who's a Native American, and he was sort of like a family friend while I was growing up. So it was always a sort of like on the precipice for me in my life. And there's a certain wisdom to the Native consciousness that I think has, for the most part, been ignored as the Industrial Revolution has really, you know, kicked off. And then subsequently in our lifetimes, this digital revolution, right? So I think all of that can be healed in a way if we reconcile and recognize the aspects of the Native consciousness of this continent that were sort of stolen away. And it's funny because a lot of the people at Yale were in some way a part of this, you know, what a lot of people talk about as like the World's Fair erasing history and whatnot. I mean, one of the darker things about the World's Fair was how they depicted people who were not white, right, as these sort of savages and barbarians. And, you know, that's definitely a sort of more of a racial conversation that we don't need to get into here. But there's definitely a erasing of history. Well, we could, but that's definitely not my expertise. But there's certainly an erasure of history, and it has a racial prejudice attached to it. You know, there's a lot. And nowadays, you know, people are very sensitive to racial prejudices. And
really? Are they?
I'm glad in some ways. I think it's being taken overboard in other ways. But in the sense that the Native Americans' history being told, I think it's important to recognize the actual truth of their complex culture and how these so-called anthropologists and academics kind of biased the reports of Native American culture in a way that left them, I don't know, in a bad political standing, so to speak. And we see the effects of that today with, you know, Native Americans for the most part living on reservations that are controlled by the military, at least in the United States. So yeah, it's a long history, and the first Indian wars took place in New Haven, where I'm from. I mean, they got kicked off in not just New Haven, but New England at large. The colonies, the New Haven colony, Connecticut colony, Plymouth colony, the Massachusetts Bay colony, went to war against the Native Americans, because at that point in 1676, the Native Americans were like, you know what, we're tired of it. Let's get together. Let's get these Europeans out of here once and for all. Funny enough, 100 years later, the colonists did the same thing to the British, but that's a different story. When it comes to the Native Americans, they certainly had a strong grasp on agriculture. They had a strong grasp on astronomy, even oceanic travel. I mean, there were many Native tribes, at least here in New England, that were whaling. You know, and they taught the European colonists how to whale. So the whole whaling industry that kind of gave birth to, you know, some of the aspects of the Industrial Revolution were thanks in part to Native American traders and sailors who were, you know, able to help guide certain groups to be more profitable, like Nantucket and Massachusetts Bay, they made tons of money whaling, almost to the point where the whales went extinct and they had to protect the whales. So that's just one aspect. But when it comes to the Native Americans, they also had a complex spiritual culture. One of the things that they talked about were a time long ago when giants and thunderbirds roamed, and even Sasquatch and some of the things that are a little more recently tangible. I mean, these were all a part of their worldview, these mythic creatures, you know? And one of the things that really struck me as coincidental and fascinating is a story about Mithras, right? Because Mithras is said to have been born from a stone giant, okay? And at Yale University, they have a shrine to Mithras. Well, that's all well and good. You know, we're talking about historical artifacts here in this art gallery. Of course, they have a Mithras shrine. Well, what do you think about the coincidence that not only did they have a Mithras shrine, but they have a stone giant here in New England, only one town away from New Haven? The Native Americans believe that this mountain called Sleeping Giant was an actual giant that once lived and roamed and did things around, you know, this area, like rerouting the course of the Connecticut River and fighting a thunderbird to his death. And this stone giant is pretty prominent. It's noticeable when you're driving on the highway. You can see the mountain is the shape of a man lying on his back. So, you know, without the native myth attached to it, it's still, you know, a human looking mountain. And here at Yale University, as you can see on the slide, we have a shrine to Mithras. And like I said, Mithra is said to have been born from a stone giant. So, you know, this is just one example of cult strange activity going on at Yale University. And it goes back, you know, very, very far. It goes back to the founding, actually, of Yale University. So with that being said, I kind of just said a lot there. You guys have any questions?
Ben, you got anything? You look like your wheels were turning a little bit. When you first said wailing, I thought you meant like how to cry or scream. And then you said, oh, the whales almost went extinct. I'm like, why would they teach them how to wail? I didn't even know that was something they
talk about. Wailing.
Yeah, wailing.
Yeah, W-H-A-L.
Whale. So the question that I had that popped into my head was there several documentaries and podcasts that I had heard talking about the Native American mounds that are all over the place, and specifically talking about the giants. In multiple different tribes, you typically have the more mounds that are present, you have more giant lore typically that comes out of those Native tribes. And for a very long time, kind of like the joke about Columbus showing up and saying, "Ah, oh, I found them. There, we found the Indians." Nope, we're Native Americans. Are you sure you're not Indians? Yeah, we're Native Americans.
That's a big
we're
deal.
We're gonna call you Indians.
Yeah.
Is the idea that there has been from us the purported they built the mounds? And from people that have gone and spoken to different chiefs of tribes, they still retain that, no, our people did not make these mounds. These mounds were made by the giants that used to be present. Mm-hmm. And they have so many very specific verbal stories or oral history that talk about when they fought the giants, and that these mounds were not made by them. They were made by the giants. So with where you're going with the skull and bones, which I noticed that it said restricted to men, and obviously that's a thing that they still carry on. Did you end up uncovering anything that had to do with the burial mounds or burial or otherwise Native American mounds that had to tie in with your research into the skull and bones?
Absolutely. I'm really glad you brought that up, Ben. So just to be clear, The giant I spoke of is considered more of a mythical giant, more of a manitou, a spirit, right? Now, the giants you're talking about, those would be more of a giant humanoid or 7 to 8 foot tall people, sometimes 9 to 10 foot tall humanoids, right? We are Neanderthal, maybe they're Sasquatch, maybe they're humans. We don't know, but we found their skeletons in the mounds. And one of the things that really struck me when I got into the Skull and Bones research was this illustration that you could actually find when you type in secret societies on Google and you go to the Wikipedia page. It's the picture they use is the main picture for the Wikipedia page. And it's a drawing of each of the Yale secret society buildings. And in each corner next to the illustrations of the buildings, there are symbols. There's a symbol of a man wearing a mask over his eyes. There's a symbol of a bat. There's a symbol of maybe hand shaking. And then there's a symbol of what looks like a stone beehive. And initially I thought, okay, that's the Masonic beehive. But then as I started looking deeper, I started to see that illustration being drawn in books about Native Americans here in New England, where they had these stone chambers. And I started thinking about these stone chambers, and it turns out in this part of the Americas, they're just not the same, you know, earth that they have maybe out in the Midwest. So it's a little harder to build mounds here, especially with the cold winters. So they would build them out of stone instead, make these massive stone piles. You can still find many of them in the woods. And there's even some that have been ransacked or dug up, and they've found everything from giant skeletons to men wearing suits of armor, as if people from Europe had come over to
the
world prior to Columbus, right? And there's the whole saga of the Knights Templar. Scott Walters looked into that at length, if people are interested in going down that rabbit hole. But again, these early Ivy League institutions, Harvard, Yale, you know, they created the rest of the university network. For the most part, people who graduated from Yale, Harvard, Princeton, College of William and Mary, University of Pennsylvania, they went on to create sort of the status quo of what's historical and what's not. And you see with a lot of these guys who were part of secret societies, they're also, you know, anthropologists or people who went on to, you know, do surveys of land and dig up these mounds or be a part of the Smithsonian Society or the Philosophical Society and these other groups that dealt in this kind of thing of what's real history and what's not. So it seems like a cover-up's going on. Why would they want to cover up, you know, what the giants were or what the Native Americans were up to? Well, it gets very complicated. I was just speaking with a Native American elder who... That podcast will be out. There's several podcasts I've recorded with him. It'll be out soon. And one of the things that he's an expert in is the mound builders. And what he told me that sometime around 400 BC, the Chinese sailed up the Mississippi River and they brought smallpox with them. And this is why the mounds were all vacant when the French came and settled. Oh, wow. That is so weird. I just mentioned Lauren, and he just called me.
Yeah, not to interrupt you, dude, but real quick, the Chinese up the Mississippi? So
yeah,
kind of throws some shit off just by itself, right?
Well, it's definitely anachronistic to what we're told. You know, we're told that the Chinese maybe went down to, like, Peru, but, you know, like the Mississippi, they definitely... don't acknowledge that, but there's evidence, and the Native Americans certainly remember. They have stories of it. And one of the weird things that you learn about when you look into this is around that same time that the Chinese allegedly sailed to the New World, they're also figuring out how to heal people from smallpox. So they invented the first V word, right? And this is going on YouTube or not, but we'll just say V word.
Yeah, sharp thing, V word, whatever you want to call it.
No, that works. We were talking about vaginas earlier. It's fine.
Yeah, so they invent this thing to essentially take a smallpox scab, grind it up into powder, and like shoot it down the back of someone's throat, which is disgusting. But apparently that made you, you know, not immunocompromised to smallpox, right? Your immune system was able to take it in, digest it, figure it out, and now you are safe. So
in theory, of course.
That may be the result of a number of things, but the fact is there was smallpox among the Chinese, and the mound builders did mysteriously disappear suddenly, right? There's archaeological evidence to suggest that all of a sudden they were just not there. So that could be a result of some sort of plague, smallpox type of, you know, illness that spread across the mound building culture. There could be other reasons. I mean, if the Chinese found these giants, maybe they would have, you know, done that purposely. There's stories of the Spanish using pigs for that purpose. They would take pigs and send them to tribes where maybe the tribes were particularly tough. And not only would the pigs wreak havoc on, you know, the farmland and whatnot, but they brought a lot of illness with them. So, you know, pigs were kind of used as biological warfare by the Spanish. So it's not far-fetched. I mean, Genghis Khan used to shove a bunch of smallpox bodies into a what do they call those things? The trebuchets, those
The catapult. Yeah,
catapult. That's the real word for it.
Just they would motherfuckers over with diseases.
Would catapult sick people into their enemies' forts. So biological warfare is not new. It's very
that's resourceful. Right.
That's darkly hilarious.
Yeah, when you think about it, it definitely, you know, goes to show how intelligent people have been throughout the ages, and at what lengths people will go to, you know, gain power. But
die spitefully, use others.
Yeah, I mean, if that kind of thing was going on amongst the Mongols, I mean, it's not theoretically impossible for the Chinese to have done something here in the New World like that, especially when you look at all the other evidence. So, you know, there's a lot of stories about alleged pre-Columbian expeditions to the New World prior to Columbus.
Right.
And some of them are accepted by the mainstream, but for the most part, Columbus gets all the credit, right? And that was due partly to these secret societies trying to control the political narrative and maybe take some power away from the Native Americans. And, you know, that's definitely the more political angle. But I think there's a spiritual angle too. Go ahead, Ben.
I was going to say that, yeah, the only other two that I ever heard about growing up was Leif Erikson prior to Columbus and Cortez. Those were the only two that I ever remember hearing about. And it wasn't until, you know, in the last, I would say, decade of our age of information, actually finding out a lot more. And when you have all those little tiny dots that connect the details to the bigger dots that people always would say are conspiracy or it isn't quote unquote authenticated history. And then you end up finding out that, I'm sorry, there's too many little dots to support this, to say that there isn't at least something to this, not to mention that the Native Americans still, like many other cultures, they primarily deal with oral history. And it is very important to get those facts correct. And when you start to hear these different stories, you can only have so many stories line up so perfectly to where you cannot dismiss it in the very least, much less take it seriously and start investigating it to be true.
Excuse me. Yeah. Well said. I think that, you know, if people realized how many cultures visited this continent before Columbus, they would really scratch their head and think twice about what the Spanish and the British and the French and the Dutch all did. But, you know, that's a different kind of story. But yeah, I have another slide that shows not just Leif Erikson, but like 10 or 12 other people who made it to the New World before Columbus. So yeah, it's very fascinating. And when you start looking at some of the megalithic structures around the world, specifically the ones in North America, it makes you wonder, you know, who built them. And, you know, people hear that and they think of the mounds, but there's so many more megalithic structures than just the mounds. There's all these great stone structures across New England. So here's Lee Ferrickson sort of looking kind of crazy. But if you look down here at the bottom, Bjarni Hardrolfsson, he actually made it to the New World before Lee Ferrickson, and they were both from the same country. St. Brendan, also of Ireland, allegedly made it to the New World in 550. There's also this African king from Mali who sailed to the New World with over 4,000 ships. And, you know, it's like you send 4,000 ships over to the New World, I think some of them are going to make it. Those are pretty good odds.
Can you scroll? I can't see all of the dates on that bottom.
Yeah, the little bar here is kind of...
Oh, there we go.
Nicole, maybe if I zoom in, you can see it. But yeah, the date's 986 is when Bjarni made it. Prince Madoc is probably the most interesting of all of these folks because he has a whole story of kind of interacting with the Native Americans, and some say even was killed in a battle against some Native American tribes all the way in Mobile, Alabama, in like, you know, the 1100s, right? So, and this was a Welsh royal who was related to King Arthur, right? Not the mythical King Arthur, but the King Arthur
right.
existed and maybe was mythical. I mean, some people say that they just based the stories off of him. Other people argue that no, King Arthur was a real figure, like the stories depict, just sort of exaggerated.
There has been a lot from the Arthurian legends and romance stories, because that's always been something that I was very fascinated with. That, yeah, the stories are obviously conflated legends, but are based off of, like, for instance, the Arthurian legend that is magical, where you have Merlin and a lot of that. And then you have the romance side of it, which is where you get a lot more into the who fucked who with Guinevere and all of that stuff. It ends up being that they think that the Arthurian legend that has to do mostly with the romance saga is much more factual. And they do think that based on who lived when and this, that, and the other, the bastard sons of Arthur, as well as his dad, Uther, that there were a lot of truth to some of these legends, but obviously, you know, completely blown out of the water and exaggerated. They don't know if Merlin by that name was a council of people that's the thing, is that it was all, you know, potions and common herbal potions and stuff that they knew, which they also say very well could have come from the Chinese. And because he was literate and a lot of the people back then were not, his books and tomes basically were translated stuff from China, and that was, you know, all of his herbs and things like that that he would do to heal people gave him this magical kind of status. But I did notice on that list, as far as the dates go, the whole thing of, you know, in 1492 Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Of all those dates, the only one that was after that was Sir Francis Drake. That
right.
All the rest of them, yeah, were all before him.
Well, and I include him because part of that presentation I share, and we can get into this information since we're sort of already dancing around it, is after I was looking into all these, you know, alleged prior visitations to the New World, you know, before Columbus, I started to piece together the fact that it seems like the dragon story comes from America. Now, this sounds strange at first, but remember the date I said about China, 400 BC. That's around the same time that the dragon becomes a part of Chinese mythology, and it was at first something only the emperor could depict or talk about. And the only person who knew about these, you know, expeditions was the emperor. right? He was the only one who sent these. He knew that the ships were going to the new world, but they didn't tell everybody about that. That was a big secret. So the dragon was always associated with the kings of China, right? Initially. And it's around this same time period that the Chinese went to America, which the word America comes from the Incas. The Incas had a being like Quetzalcoatl called Amaruku, and that's the word that became America. They could have named it Turtle Island, but turtles aren't fearsome enough. You know, that's what the natives called North America is Turtle Island. I don't know what they called South America, but North America was called Turtle Island, and somebody came up with America. I haven't figured out who, but some people think it connects to that dragon. And Sir Francis Drake, dragon, Draco, right? I mean, there's a big connection there. He was the first British person to make it to the West Coast. And what's interesting about Baja California and I think San Francisco is if you look at them close enough on a map from above, kind of look like a serpent, like moving along the coast of California, and San Francisco Bay even kind of looks like the mouth of a snake from a certain angle. So it's kind of interesting, like when you see these dragons on the landscape. There's other examples of this. Louisiana and the Appalachian Mountains make a sort of dragon shape as well. But all that aside, the dragon didn't come into Western mythology until after Prince Madoc's expedition, and he was a Welsh person. Who has the dragon on their flag? The Welsh do. Everyone else, for the most part, has a lion or the Roman eagle.
The phoenix or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, but the dragon is kind of new to the European world in the same period that Prince Madoc allegedly sailed to the New World. So it's like, maybe the Native Americans, they saw these dragons. They called them Thunderbirds. They called them Quetzalcoatl. In South America, they called them Amaruku, you know, and maybe that's the myth that kind of was most popular for visitors here. And that's why they went back home and spread this dragon idea. Maybe the dragon is from America. That's kind of what I'm starting to hypothesize. I don't have much more to substantiate that other than what I kind of just said. But even Africa, there's evidence that people from Africa traveled across the Atlantic and settled in the New World, and there are stories of dragons in African culture as well. So and you don't see dragons in other cultures. You see them, you know, in cultures that have been in contact with the Chinese or the European or the African cultures, but you see for the most part like giant snakes or serpents instead of this more dragon-like dinosaur kind of looking thing, right, with legs and wings, where as the serpent is usually just what we think of as a snake, maybe just bigger, like the Nagas of India. You know,
our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Oftentimes people will compare the Nagas of India to the dragon, but they're kind of different in the sense that, you know, dragons typically have a different anatomy. Although these are mythical beings, it's a certain interpretation.
As far as we know, yeah.
Well, let's look at it this way. Yale University, these people that I mentioned earlier who are, you know, finding themselves in these positions to sort of wrap up history neatly with a bow and give people right angle that they want them to see. Well, they were the people who invented, for the most part, paleontology. there was a part of Yale University that kind of developed paleontology out of the science of mineralogy. And these two paleontologists, one of them who happened to be connected to Skull and Bones, they had this fight called the Bone Wars, where the two of them competed to name the most dinosaurs. And during this process, they basically just dug up bones and said, oh, this is a new species. Oh, this is a new species. And it really was more about their competition between mm-hmm. than it was actually naming dinosaurs. So what if, just like we have these giant skeletons that have been hidden away, what if there are dragon skeletons that they're just telling us are dinosaurs instead? They're giving us this different scientific version of dragons, this sort of, you know, walking dragon, as a way of kind of demystifying the history of this place and giving people a more, I don't know, scientific, dead materialist version of the world.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that makes perfect sense because it lines up with the whole evolution, Big Bang thing. It can be like, oh, the dinosaurs were here so long ago and they just got taken out by an asteroid or whatever it was. Before we get too far off of where you're going, I wanted to ask real quick, what's the answer for the Native Americans being here before all of these other so-called first-time explorers or first-time, you know, finders of the New World? Because the way we grew up, there shouldn't have been anybody here. And as far as we knew back when we were going, we were taking school, whatever, Columbus was the first one. Yeah, we didn't go to school. We took school.
I get it.
So when Columbus came here, he was the first one to find this world. And there was already people here doing their thing. That doesn't work from a Christian chronological point of view at all. I've never heard a Christian that
explains that. That's 100% why. Because they were so mystical and spiritual, and they were like, we need to wipe this shit out. I don't want anybody to find out about this.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense that so many people were supposedly finding this new world. But way before that, there was the Native American tribes that were apparently here for a long fucking time because they have their own mythologies and ideas on things. Does that work from any other viewpoint, like the out of Africa idea that everybody was out of Africa, or the Pangaea when everything was kind of one landmass and then it split apart? Or
keep in mind, they didn't have any of that in the 1500s, right? When the Spanish came, you know, there was no Pangaea theory yet, right? So I understand what you're saying, but back then it was about, the Bible, that's how people got educated, maybe the classics, right? The classic Roman and Greek literature and then literature of the day. And that was what education was based around. So then the colonists, what we are told they said, you know, for that explanation to your question, which is a good question, they tended to think that the natives were survivors of the flood, sons of Joseph, and Babylonians. So they considered themselves possibly either a lost tribe of Israel or some sort of survivors of the flood that maybe God just ignored, right? And that was sort of talked about in books at the time. And there were people like Roger Williams, who actually founded the state of Rhode Island. It was then called Providence. He was sort of a heretic to the people in Boston. The people in Boston at the time were super religious in a certain one-way persuasion, very Protestant, very against the Church of England, but they kind of created their own quasi Church of England here in Boston, right? They became the enemy they hated. And people like Roger Williams, who sympathized with the Native Americans, were not considered, you know, like sane to these Bostonians, who for the most part were slave traders and treated the Native Americans like they were unworthy of the land unless they converted to Christianity. So you see the first missionary schools in New England, converting certain Native Americans and then sending those Native Americans out to be missionaries. And what's really sad is these Christian Indians who did convert for various reasons, they were for the most part ignored and disregarded during the Indian wars that took place. They're officially known as King Philip's War. King Philip wasn't a European. He was a Native American that the colonists would call King Philip because his real name was too hard to remember. His name was Metacomet, and he was sort of like the leader of the natives who said, all right, we're sick of this. Let's get these English out of here. And it was a complicated story. You know, there were tribes like the Mohegans who sided with the British. There were other tribes like the ones who converted to Christianity who sided with the British. But it got to a point where all of the natives were considered the enemy. Even if they were loyal, they couldn't be trusted because they could, you know, turn on us. So a lot of these Christianized Indians got put on Deer Island in Massachusetts off the coast of Boston. And none of them made it through the winter. Very few did, at least. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a tragedy what happened in the East Coast of America during the colonial phase. But thanks to Roger Williams, you know, the Narragansetts, for the most part, were spared. They didn't have to fight in the Indian War. They survived. And there are other tribes like the Wepawag who still have a nation, the Mohegans who still have a strong nation, and even the Mohawk, who were kind of the feared enemies of the natives' day, you know, they still have survived. So a lot of these tribes are still in existence, but as Ben said, their cultures, their stories were all passed down orally. So a lot of this stuff, you know, has been unfortunately hidden from the most of us. And, you know, I feel privileged to learn a lot of this stuff, but I'm only sharing what's available in books. You know, there are certain things I've learned from my friends that are natives that they tell me, you know, this isn't something that we like to share with anyone. So I'm going to share it with you, but you can't share it with anyone else. And there's a part of me that disagrees with that because we're truther podcasters. We love the truth. We want everybody to know the truth, and we all want to escalate and elevate each other. But there also is some respect that needs to be given to a people and a culture that for the most part have been genocided, you know, and that's a really harsh word, but it's the reality that they faced. So, you know, the New England history is very interesting. There's so many characters, but when it comes to your question about, you know, what the colonists thought, it's kind of a mixed bag, but for the most part, they regarded the natives as unworthy of owning the land because they weren't, you know, God's people. And for the most part, I mean, the Native American spiritual worldview was more complex than a lot of the Christians who were coming here, just because, you know, the Christians, for the most part, they had a very simple dogma and also a very complicated and hard life in Europe. You know, and I'm not in any way biased against either party. I think both parties, you know, are human beings, and we need to just separate, you know, our morals of today when we look at history. But still, it's definitely, you know, a touchy subject when you look at it, because you could just chalk it all up to racism, but really it was more of a religious idea. It kind of evolved into manifest destiny, right? That America was destined to be here, and this new world was being preserved by God from the evils of the Catholic Church and the evils of Rome and all the bad things from the old world. God had preserved this new world for the Americas to be born, right? And that's kind of the myth of manifest destiny that a lot of the colonists were really inspired by. And, you know, if that didn't happen, well, maybe we wouldn't have the Constitution, which I know we all are grateful for, and the Native American consciousness contributed to that document. So I guess that's kind of where I jump in and say, like, yeah, maybe we just need to recognize and give respect to our brothers who were here before us, who you know, made the earth ready for America. Because, you know, there is a way that we can all live here in harmony, and we can free them from the reservation and all be equals, you know. I think that's definitely on the horizon. It should happen. So if this kind of research leads to that, great. But, you know, if we want to maybe sidetrack a bit back to our original topic of Skull and Bones, because they are a part of that, but, you know, I mostly looked into it from that perspective of, well, why do they have Geronimo's skeleton? So maybe we can
ask that confirmed? Because I have heard that. That's a fucking weird thing for a Yale, like, fraternity to have, is somebody's real skeleton, especially Geronimo.
Well, it's not the whole skeleton. Allegedly, it's just the femur bones and the skull. But they don't just have Geronimo. They have a lot of people. They have, apparently, they have Martin Van Buren, who's the only president who isn't related to all the other presidents, right? You guys have seen that meme of all the
yeah
related to each other. And, you know, that's kind of odd. They also have Churchill, the guy who, not Churchill, sorry, it's the guy who changed England, Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell. They have his skull.
Old Ironsides, right?
Yeah. No, that's Churchill, I think. But but no, I don't think they have Churchill. They have Cromwell. But anyways, yeah, and then they have like Pancho Villa. They have some random Russian lady and probably on and on and on. They probably have tons of skeletons down there. For what purpose? I think it's a spiritual one. You know, like they have some sort of ritual attached to these body parts that comes from maybe Mithraism, the Mithraic cult. Maybe it comes from Templarism and the Templars. I'm not quite sure where that practice originates, but clearly it's something that they were doing. There are stories of Yeomen being, you know, caught red-handed with this kind of stuff, and people have broken into the tomb and recorded what's in there. So,
I got a question for you on that, and I was super glad that it happened to be your segue right there of going back to Skull and Bones, bringing up the presidents, owning and doing, you know, what's it called, different ceremonies and stuff like that. Was is Skull and Bones directly, obviously with the participants, yes, but are they, what is their connection with the massive Bohemian Grove ties? Because I just looked it up about, you know, they get together all the time mid-July in what is it, in California, and it was the elite across the world, men's only club, just like all the other secret societies. I know John Kerry and George Bush, the most recent both runners and also president, that admitted to being in Yale's Skull and Bones, even though they were going against each other in the presidential race. Did you unearth anything about Skull and Bones and, you know, the 1878 onward of these prominent figures getting all together at Bohemian Grove, and what other secret societies might be included in that?
Yeah. Well, luckily with Skull and Bones, a lot of the research has been done before me by a very excellent scholar named Anthony Sutton, who wrote a book about Skull and Bones called America's Secret Establishment. It's right here. And there's another really excellent book put together by a guy I've interviewed named Chris Milligan called Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. So in this book, he shows a diagram that basically puts the Skull and Bones order at the center of this matrix of groups. It's not just Bohemian Grove. It's the Council of Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergs. Skull and Bones is one of these groups that seems to have infiltrated all of those. And with Bohemian Grove in specifically, I found out from a listener of the show that reached out to me with this information that allegedly Bohemian Grove started in Huntington, Long Island. And that's an interesting place because Huntington was one of the prominent families in the New Haven area, and many of the Huntington have been part of Skull and Bones, including the founder, who was William Huntington Russell. So he had a brother, Samuel Russell, who was an opium smuggler. They started the Russell Trust Association to incorporate Skull and Bones. And then Skull and Bones became a sort of parasite that took over Yale University itself. And now Yale University is the second wealthiest private university in the country at $42 billion of an endowment, which is larger than a lot of countries, and half of what the wealthiest monarch in the world has. The king of Thailand is the wealthiest monarch, and I think he has like $70 billion or something like that. So Yale is right there at half of that. A little bit of money magic going on for sure, but yeah, Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, they're certainly connected, maybe even sort of founded by because the University of California, which Stanford is a part of, which Stanford is a huge school, especially connected to the MKUltra topic, the topic of, you know, the music industry being affected. I mean, the whole Laurel Canyon scene. So the University of California, Berkeley, was started by members of Skull and Bones. And yeah, they're very much connected to this whole thing, even going to the Manhattan Project and the creation of the nuclear bomb. And yeah, I mean, on and on and on. They financed the Nazis in World War II and World War I, Skull and Bones did. So, you know, there's plenty of things that they've gotten themselves in, and I don't know quite where they stand now. Like I said, you know, obviously George Bush was Skull and Bones. We've heard the rumors that Obama is potentially related to the Bush family. So you can imagine that if Biden is just Obama's little puppet, then, you know, we're seeing Bush 3.0 right now, right? Maybe we had with Trump, but I think that's essentially the same dynasty. But it seems like there's a new left-leaning orientation to these sort of political deep state actors, right? You know, it shifted. Whereas during the Bush era, it was more of the neocon. Now the neocons are perfectly comfortable taking on the role of, you know, ultra left, right? And I think that's the problem with these organizations, is they just use, you know, names, identities, political ideologies as cover for their agenda. They don't care, you know, if it's red or blue or Dem or Republican, whatever it is, as long as it pushes their agenda forward. And they do that by educating the wealthiest of the wealthy at these insulated schools and plucking the right candidates from those already insulated populations. You know, only 15 people a semester, a senior. You know, when you become a senior, you join these secret societies. You don't, it's not like a regular fraternity where you join as a freshman and you fuck around for 4 years. These guys are only there as a senior, and after they get initiated into Skull and Bones, they're done with school. So there's no, like, you know, flirting around with their classmates, telling them about the boogie rituals they did last year, because they're gone, you know, and the only friends that they are expected to keep are those men that they were initiated with, or women now too, who are welcome to join these secret societies. So, you know, it's gone past that sort of trope of a bunch of scary old white men in a, you know, boardroom plotting the end of humanity. You know, now there's chicks with blue hair and, you know, trans dudes and who knows what else going into the secret societies. And I, you know, I'm not against anybody expressing themselves, but that's just the times that we're in, right? So they're not going to conform to anything but the trends. And maybe they're even kind of sort of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Forcing the trend?
Well, yeah, encouraging encouraging depravity, really, is what it is. It feels like we're kind of heading into a more and more depraved culture. If you look at, like, what's acceptable in children's media, what's acceptable in adult media, you know, it's really taken a large leap off of a cliff in the past 60 years. So, I think these organizations, we can't count them out when we look at how these whole movements got influenced, because they're in control of the education system, the upper echelon of the education system. And even, you know, regular state university schools were founded by members of Skull and Bones, you know. So it's a deep entangled web that spans the entire history of the country, because Yale University is older than the United States itself. So is Harvard. And they both are connected to Oxford and Cambridge, which are, you know, almost 1,000 years old at this point. So we're dealing with this sort of vestige of the old control system that transmuted itself during the Renaissance from royalty to secret society. And now we're seeing those transform into technocratic corporatists, right? These like yacht sailing, you know.
Yeah, education. Yes.
Yeah. So
what, you know, what do you think that, like, when it comes out, you said so insulated of a school because you have to be have a certain amount of money to go there in the first place. But even if you're just some random ass dude who just happened to have so much money to go to Yale or Harvard or any of these Ivy League schools, when it comes down to how select few get into Skull and Bones and then, or, you know, any of those, and then the select few from there that we actually hear about, like Bush or Obama, you know, the top players. Was there something else going on behind who they pick besides how well they do at fucking a human skull or whatever they do in there? Is it, does it come down to their bloodline specifically? Because you talked about them being all kind of related. So, it, like, if I would just, if I had $1 billion right now and just went to Yale, somehow got into Skull and Bones, I don't think that I would necessarily be picked because they look at my bloodline and be like, no, that's not what we're looking for. Do you think it's something like that?
Well, it most definitely. I think it could be, you know, the rare case where somebody gets involved because their father's industry maybe or something like that. But for the most part, I think it's familial, it's bloodlines. And, you know, that's evidence when you look at George Bush because, you know, I live not too far from New Haven. I worked in New Haven for many years and went to bars in New Haven. And one of the bars that I went to had a lot of rumors about George Bush while he was a student at Yale. You know, he was doing coke in the bathroom. He was having Secret Service come and pick him up because he couldn't drive, you know, three blocks, you know, home or whatever.
He's responsible. Hey, could have drove.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of weird stories. I don't know how true they all are, but there's a lot of stories that George W. Bush was a party boy, H.W. Bush, right? The younger Bush.
Yeah.
He was a party boy, and his family was kind of like New Haven born and bred. His father went to Yale. His grandfather went to Yale, and they both were in Skull and Bones. So when you have a situation like that, yeah, the great-grandson is going to be Skull and Bones as well. So who knows who's in Skull and Bones now, Bush 4. But I don't know how much sway they have anymore. But yeah, it's definitely familial. I think it could be different nowadays because they are accepting a lot of international students. So one of the thoughts I've had is like, well, maybe there are prominent families in China now that send their students who, you know, their father's a part of the freaking, what do they call it, the triads, and they send their son to go become part of Skull and Bones. Like that definitely could be going on where like secret societies from other nations are kind of getting involved in Skull and Bones as a sort of power grab on Skull and Bones' part.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to kind of allude to was when Joe was talking about, you know, he wouldn't be picked. It's like, no, you wouldn't for being that puppet that they want and need, but it's the idea that you would still play a role as a foot soldier and the support of that information. And there's that kind of faux and fake, like, bequeathing of giving you information that you need to support for the person that will be picked. And when you just now mentioned the idea of other people getting in, or other secret societies getting brought into Skull and Bones, it's almost one of those, I think that is more realistic, where the society itself has definitely outlasted the puppets. They're the ones that are putting these royalty families and keeping those in check, and whoever it is, the committee or what have you, that controls Skull and Bones, they're the ones that you'll never hear any of the names of. You know, we talk about the elites, the deep state, the puppet masters. I would say that much like the Masons, it's the society itself and their secrets. That is what is way older than any of these monarchs or the bloodlines themselves. It's the idea that they're the ones who choose what bloodlines go into all of these countries, and maybe even a front of some of these secret societies are just to throw people off the trail, where it's like, no, we own this society. As a matter of fact, we started it. We started whatever it is that they purport, and we're going to say that this guy who's going to be prominent in this nation or in this state or whatever,
we're going to say that he's a part of this secret society and kind of take him out, quote unquote, in the public eye of being in Skull and Bones. But in reality, it's just another hand to the head. And the idea that that other society that they're a part of, oh, see, look, we have a president or, you know, whatever, that's not a part of Skull and Bones. He's a part of this fraternity. And it's like, right, but Skull and Bones started that fraternity and are labeling him as such so that it throws everybody off the trail as to what is all connected to it. I would say that that's a bigger force than the actual, you know, puppet heads they put in.
Hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think there's something going on like that. It definitely happened with the Masons prior to Skull and Bones. It's one of the reasons that the Skull and Bones possibly even got into America, because apparently they were German. The first chapter of Skull and Bones was in a German university. And right around the time that Skull and Bones was founded in 1832, in 1831, there was something called the William Morgan Affair, where a man named William Morgan became a Freemason and published some of the rituals and some of the secrets in a book, put that book out there and said, hey, the Masons are evil. Everybody needs to watch out for them. And a month later, he was missing, and they found his body washed up on the shore south of the Niagara Falls. So the whole country got worried and said, oh, gosh, these Masons, you know, they're ruthless. They're conspirators. They're corrupt. They're killing people to keep these secrets. And there was a whole political party called the Anti-Masonic Party that formed to get the Masons out of political power. And, you know, it didn't really work for the most part. I mean, you see the Masons kind of just going undercover and maybe even becoming like charitable organizations, kind of how they present themselves today as Shriners and whatnot. You know,
right. Or Bill Gates and him being a big philanthropist. They always hide behind these do-gooder type
right.
of shit.
Right.
We got to wrap up here soon, dude, but I wanted, as a closer, to what's the mainstream like rebuttal to this so-called conspiracy theory that all these people in power are part of these organizations like Skull and Bones? What do you even know what they say to somebody who would talk like you? Like, what's the mainstream response?
I think they would just chalk it up to like, you know, oh, that's just college hijinks. That's just what goes on at college.
And then I become president. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was a part of a fraternity at college, but it didn't mean like that did anything for my life. Like, I'm not like, you know, I got one job at a bakery because of a friend I made in the fraternity, but that's like the only edge.
It's like
I
being
got.
A second degree Mason. Who cares?
It's
bragging rights.
That's kind of the deal with a lot of Masons. I used to buy weed from a Freemason, and he was a cool guy. Like, I never asked him about being a Freemason that much. After he told me, I was just like, oh, cool, you know, and I just would buy weed from him still and have like, you know, a 5-minute conversation with him. And
when I was involved in the Freemasons, I sold weed. So I was probably that guy. I don't even know.
Shoot.
Have I met you before?
Most people used to not care about stuff. Now we're like, what's your vaccination status? Like, we're all about what we're all doing. But back in the day, we didn't care. We were like, that's cool for you, because it's okay if you do things that I don't like.
Yeah, we can get along.
It was a tiny bubble of time where we could do that.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody's involved with this stuff, but to rebut somebody who doubts my hypothesis, Joe, I would tell them, well, the evidence stands for itself. You look at the amount of people who left Skull and Bones and went on to do something that was world-changing or made them wealthy or affluent. It's mind-numbing. You won't find any other group that has that record of success and excellence. So
he's in coincidence, Mark. You know that.
Exactly. So, you know, with that being said, yeah, I say, you know, whether or not people think you're crazy, do your own research and find out for yourself, because the truth is out there, whether they want to accept it or not.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that unless you could condense everything you've ever said into a 15-second TikTok video, nobody's going to do their own research. They're going to watch 15 TikTok videos and be like, I saw it for myself. This is not true. This guy has 4 million followers. It couldn't not be true.
Can you imagine how much better America would be if, when people came here, they embraced the Native American culture And they don't call themselves Native Americans. That's something we call them because we want to feel really good about ourselves. So anyway, I'll call them Native Americans for the show. But if when we got here, we just said, hey, what can you teach me? Instead of being like, I'm going to blow your fucking brains out if you don't move. Or even if that happened, I don't even know.
Except
that's
Jesus.
In the history books.
Or you're getting shot.
There was a lot of weird religious persecution. So if people just came in and didn't have that on their back and they just embraced it, this would be in a fucking amazing place. We'd all be building our own cabins, having our own passed down knowledge. There would be no fucking TikTok. There would be nothing like that. Because that's bullshit.
Oh, it's a great world right there.
Kick ass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, dude, Mark, let everybody know where they can find you and any new projects you have coming up and all your links and all that, and shoot them over to me so I can put them in the notes too.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, My Family Thinks I'm Crazy is the podcast and the website. I also have a Substack. If you go to myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack and read some of my articles I've written about some of the things we've talked about today. And yeah, there's a few booklets I've written that are available on my Ko-Fi store, and of course, the shows that I put out. So that's all available on myfamilythinksimcrazy.com, and of course, altmediaunited.com, where you can find my podcast, this great podcast that we're on right now, and many others. So yeah, that's my links, just those two websites.
Perfect. That makes it easy for me as far as typing goes. Mark, good to see you again. Thanks, Ben and Lene, for joining us. Thanks, Jen, for joining us. Oh, you're always here, though. Yeah. But yeah, stay turgid, my fellow brothers. Stay turgid.
Boner.